key factor is that Europe gives away a lot more foreign aid than the United States does, the EU and the European countries. They give it to more countries. And so at any given time, if you take the European members of the UN Security Council and the countries that happen to be on the Security Council that are receiving most of their aid from the EU, this gives them a lot of clout in the United Nations. And this is the reason that President Bush couldn't pass his second resolution in the Security Council to go to war in Iraq. We blame the French and the Russians, but as a matter of fact, we couldn't get anywhere near the 9 votes needed to pass something out of the Security Council because, except for Britain, the EU members were strongly opposed, and the countries receiving aid and dependent on the EU were therefore opposed. That amounts to power. If you look at the World Trade Organization, if you look at the Kyoto Accord Organization, the vote on the International Criminal Court, the EU, although it acts as one country in many ways, it keeps its 25 separate votes in all those organizations. Plus, it gives aid around the world to countries that it can then lobby for. So the EU and its power to stand up to the United States in these international organizations is making it harder for us to achieve things. You know, this, I'll give you an example. The last big bill that came out of Congress, this massive tax bill, where they gave away bennies to lots of American corporations. Remember that?
Yeah.
That vote was forced on us by the World Trade Organization. We had this basically tax subsidy for American exporters that had been in place for 25 years. The Japanese and the Chinese wrote diplomatic letters saying, come on, please stop. The EU went to the World Trade Organization, where they control most votes, and got the World Trade Organization to issue sanctions against the United States, hundreds of millions of dollars a year in tariffs, if we didn't change this law. And the EU was very blunt about it. The EU Trade Commissioner said, what we're trying to do here is repeal a U.S. law. Does the European Union have the right to repeal U.S. laws? Well, I'll tell you what the Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert, said. I love this. He said, my gut feeling is we fought a revolution 230 years ago to stop Europeans from telling us what we tax in this country. But the fact is, we have to pass this bill. The EU has a sword over our head. We don't like it, but we have to do what the Europeans are telling us to do. What I'm arguing in this book is that's a kind of global power. It's not military power, but it's power that forced the United States to do something we didn't want to do at great expense. That's power, isn't it?
You say in your book that anybody who doesn't get how powerful the European Union is should learn the lesson that Jack Welch, the former head of GE, learned when he tried to buy Honeywell. And this was a deal that was approved in the United States. It passed muster in terms of antitrust stuff in the U.S. Justice Department, but it didn't pass the standards of the European Union. Why not?
That's exactly right. It was the biggest industrial merger in history, a $45 billion deal. And Jack Welch came up with this idea just at the beginning of the Bush administration. This is a Republican administration, you know, favorable towards business. And that deal just sailed through our antitrust department. But Europe has one single antitrust czar for 25 countries, and he held it up. He has, as I said earlier, he doesn't want to follow American antitrust rules. The fact that our Justice Department approved it didn't matter to him. And I think it's very clear that Jack Welch and GE never saw this coming. In fact, Jack Welch said, it never occurred to me that the European Union might say no. There's this great moment when Jack Welch finally goes over to Europe to see Mario Monti, the antitrust czar, decides to go to lunch with him because, you know, Welch is absolutely charming. Nobody can resist him. He goes into the restaurant and sticks out his hand and says, Mario, Jack. And Monty says, Mr. Welch, we have a regulatory proceeding underway. I believe you should refer to me as Senior Monty. And I think at that point, Welch knew he had a big problem. Europe shot it down. Welch had to come home to his board of directors and say, we can't do this $45 billion merger because Europe said no. The U.S. Treasury Secretary said, wait a minute, Europe has no right to tell two American countries. And, you know, Jack Welch is a realist. He said, yeah, they have the right because they're a bigger market than Japan or the United States. We have to sell product there, so we have to follow their law. Now, here's the point. If you look at what Jack Welch spent on that merger, he spent about $50 million on antitrust lawyers and another $25 or $30 million on investment bankers, $75 million to learn this lesson about the power of the EU. This is my big argument. For $24.95, you can learn the same argument from my book.
That's
we're talking bargain here.
So, I mean, I guess what you're saying is, like, what's the point of a merger like this if you can't sell to the European Union? I mean, that's a huge market. No one can afford to miss it.
That's exactly right. They now have the market power. As a matter of fact, the EU sets most of the commercial rules that govern international trade. I don't know if you ever buy bourbon. I buy Kentucky bourbon, and I'm so old that I can remember when you bought it as a fifth. You bought it as a quarter, a fifth of a gallon. Today, you buy a bottle of Kentucky bourbon, and it's 70 centiliters. What, do you think Americans stormed the liquor stores demanding to buy their bourbon in centiliters? No, I don't think so. It's because the EU told them to do it, and American companies have to follow these rules because it's such a massive market.
Why is it that in an era when America is becoming more deregulated, that Europe is becoming more regulated?
They believe in regulation. They like government better than we do. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And when you ask them about it, they have their success stories. I'll give you a good example. In the late 1980s, early 90s, when cell phones were starting to catch on in Europe and the United States, the United States was in a deregulatory mode, and we had several different standards. Nobody was going to impose a standard on the industry. They could set up their own standards. Europe was in this unifying mindset, this EU mindset, and they set a single standard for all of Europe. As it turned out, Americans were not happy with the fact that the cell phone you bought in Arizona wouldn't work in Massachusetts. Whereas in Europe, the same cell phone, you could buy it in Estonia and use it in Portugal. You could use it anywhere. Finally, eventually, the European standard moved all over the world. And guess what? A couple of European companies using this standard grabbed on and took hold of the cell phone industry. Nokia passed Motorola, become the number one cell phone company in the world. A network called Vodafone, which now owns Verizon, is the biggest cell phone network operator in the world, European company. And that's, the Europeans will tell you, that's because they standardize. It's because they have this union that sets single rules. So they just like regulation. They like rules better than we do.
If you're just joining us, my guest is T.R. Reid, and he's the Rocky Mountain Bureau Chief for The Washington Post, the former Tokyo and London Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. While he was the London Bureau Chief, he chronicled the rise of the European Union, and that's the subject of his new book, which is called The United States of Europe, The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more about the EU. This is Fresh Air. My guest is T.R. Reid, and he's the former Tokyo Bureau Chief and former London Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. He's now the Rocky Mountain Bureau Chief. His new book is called The United States of Europe, and it's about the European Union. It's subtitled The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy. There's a lot of companies that we may think of as being American-owned companies that are really owned by European companies. Would you do the roll call for us?
Yeah, I talk in my book about this typical American couple who decide to go for a weekend vacation. They don't have enough cash, so they go down to Household Finance in the local mall and borrow the money. They get in their Jeep. They gas up at an Amoco station. They stop at Dunkin' Donuts for breakfast. They put a Dave Matthews CD in the stereo. They're both watching their weight, so they have a super slim fast for lunch. Spend the night at a Holiday Inn. Give their dog some Alpo. And have a Miller Lite and smoke some Lucky Strikes, read a new book from the Literary Guild and pop some pay-per-view and the TV and call somebody on their Verizon phone. Classic American vacation, and every company I've just named is owned by Europeans. You know, the Jeep is owned by Daimler Chrysler. Amoco, the American oil company, is now owned by British Petroleum. Lucky Strikes is British American Tobacco. That's a British company. You just go down the list,